Good morning, everybody, members and in terms of parliamentary procedure, in the absence of the chairperson, we need to elect a standing chairperson. So can I have any nominations from the floor?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to propose the name of the Honourable Des van der Rooyen to act as Chair.
I'll second that.
Thank you, Honourable van der Rooyen, you can.
Good morning, members.
Good morning, members. Without any further ado, we do have some apologies that have been forwarded. The chairperson and Honorable Mthethwa, as well as Honorable Dubezana, they are delayed, and as a result, we had to then get this meeting going as we have just done. I would like to thank in absentia Honorable Mashiko for availing herself to make sure that we make a quorum for our meeting. We are here today to rectify double taxation conventions. And this is a process, as you are all aware, we have been briefed about these agreements. I think the only preliminary briefing that we'll do today is on Samoa, but on other countries, this process was conducted sometime last year. As you are all aware, the essence of this exercise, members, is to ensure that we deal with the most spoken about tax barriers in as far as trade between countries is concerned. But also, as part of the global economy, we are not operating in isolation. And it's very important going forward that we make sure that the environment is conducive for us to do trade in other countries, but also to allow other countries to do trade in our country. So this is part of the bigger process of ensuring that there is freedom of trade between ourselves and the global economic community. So I'm going now to accord and also welcome our team from National Treasury and SARS to take us through this particular process. Mr. Van Meva, I think you are the leader of the team. It's a joint effort. So this team is full of leadership. Thank you very much. You are more than welcome. You can take us through.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Lutando from the National Treasury, and my presentation today will only be limited to ratification presentation in respect of Oman STC protocol. As you may be aware, Chair, National Treasury is not involved in the negotiation of the exchange of information agreements. Those are agreements that fall within the function of SARS, because they are exchange of information agreements between tax administration. But we do, however, get involved on the issue of deciding whether we negotiate a treaty or an exchange of information. Today's presentation, as indicated, is limited to ratification of Oman. As you are well aware, Chair, we've come before this House before, this committee before, to present other 9 treaties that had to be renegotiated because they had a zero rate on withholding tax on dividends. Oman is one of those treaties. It has to be negotiated because we couldn't implement dividends tax without negotiating with them. Otherwise, there would have been a gap, a loophole for tax planning. The renegotiation also addressed certain aspects which were not in the existing tax treaty, such as the updating of the exchange of information article. As you may be aware, Chair, the new dividends tax will come into operation in a few weeks on 1st April 2012, as the Minister announced in his budget speech. This protocol was signed on 15 November in Oman, 15 November 2011. In the next slide, I also give an update of the other tax protocols that were presented before this committee. Australia is in force. Netherlands is in force. Ireland will only come into force on 1st April 2012. Malta is still making arrangements for the signature. Kuwait is still making arrangements for the signature, and Cyprus also the case. Oman is the one that we're now presenting before this committee. Seychelles was ratified in December. Sweden will also come into force on 1st April 2012. The United Kingdom protocol is in force. Once this House ratifies this protocol, the administrative process will then follow, such as notification of Oman via diplomatic channels. And once Oman ratifies, they'll do the same, and the agreement will then come into force on the date that will be agreed between the two countries. Thank you, Chair. As you may notice, I didn't present any investment flows, because this is an existing agreement. It's already in force, but we just amended certain parts of the agreement. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Tando. So we will proceed with the other
question. Thank you, Chair. there are two basic articles in this protocol, which is indicated by my colleague, Mr. Mbovo. Refer basically to the introduction of the dividends tax from 1 April 2012 and the corresponding abolishment of the STC. The other issue that we had to deal with in our original double taxation agreement with Oman, Chair, we had the normal ANC transport article extending to Oman's partnership participation in a company called Gulf Air, which was a partnership between, if I remember correctly, Bahrain, Oman, and one other who escapes me right now. So that Oman's share of the profits from that company, which went across three countries, would be dealt with in accordance with the South Africa-Oman Treaty. Oman withdrew from that partnership, and therefore they asked us to delete that particular provision with effect from November 2007, when they were no longer a partner of Gulf Air. So we didn't have a problem with that, Chair. The other thing was, of course, to introduce source state right of taxation in respect of dividends paid from South African companies. Well, it's bilateral, but in our particular area of interest, it was to have a taxing right on dividends flowing from South African companies to shareholders resident in Oman. They agreed to that, and that particular article now provides that in respect of that flow of dividends, the source state, that's state where the company paying the dividends is resident, has a 5% rate of withholding if the shareholding is 10% or more, and in all other cases 10%. So it's typical in all our double taxation agreements, Chair, that we have a dual rate of withholding in respect of dividends, because we like to encourage greater participation, greater investment in South African ventures or in companies which are set up here. So the incentive here is you must be at least a 10% shareholder, then you get the lower rate. And those are the two issues in this protocol, Chair. I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
I wonder if members would like us to take other presentation, or like us to entertain Oman and get done with Oman and go to other presentation. I'm not sure which approach would like us to take.
Chair, question that might apply to the other
Okay.
A question relating to the dividend rate of 10%. Now, I understand, and it's a question that we in the committee are struggling with the legal basis, that the dividend rate that the minister has recommended is 15%. And there's a bit of uncertainty as to the legal basis. Here I see it's 10%. Well, this, what is the implication of that? Should the minister be correct in his legal interpretation that he can raise it to 15%, will then be an adjustment, or will this stay 10%? And does this carry through to your other treaties as well, so that we understand the principle? Thank you.
Maybe let's check if there are other questions, so as we can get a comprehensive response. Yes, Honourable Tim.
Thanks, Chair. I just, if I can go back to Treasury's presentation, So slide number 3 says that there are 9 treaties that had a zero rate on withholding tax on dividends. I would imagine that the table on the next page summarizes them, but there are actually 10 on that page. So just clarity on which agreements will need to be resolved by the 1st of April. And then I understand there's a status given on each of them. But does that mean that they will all be done by the 1st of April? Is there any risk that any of our protocols won't be updated by that time?
Any further questions?
Information on
that. Thank you, Chair. Yes. In relation to the first question, in domestic law, I think it's the country's sovereign right to decide what percentage withholding to apply in domestic law. And if the minister and parliament agree to the 15% rate, that in effect won't affect the treaties at all, because the principle is that an international agreement creates obligations between states in international law. And therefore, you have to meet those obligations. And the treaty, therefore, where there's a conflict between domestic law and the treaty is superior. It overrides domestic law. So even if our domestic law should say 15% in future, the rate set out in the treaty will be the maximum that apply in the relationship between the two countries. I hope that's...
Yeah, I think there was a
fire.
Let's just conclude.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Yes, you correctly indicate that we have 10 treaties. The reason why we have 10, we have Netherlands, which was a renegotiation of a full treaty. It had to be renegotiated because it was very old. It had to be updated, the whole treaty. It was not a protocol. It was a comprehensive treaty. And the rest are protocols.
There we go. Sorry. I think the issue here was that we always had a withholding rate with Australia, but there were significant changes to the Australian treaty. The other 9 had zero rates, and they were renegotiated to have a withholding rate in the source state. We always had a withholding rate in relation to Australia. there was never a gap, if I could call it that, Chair.
With regards to the with regards to the second question, the signing of Malta, Kuwait, and Cyprus, we cannot guarantee this committee that they will be signed before 1st April. Because we've been struggling with the logistics of signing. Those other countries, for example, with Kuwait, only the minister can sign the agreement, and therefore it can only be signed if there's a visit to Kuwait by any of our cabinet ministers or a Kuwait minister coming here. But in terms of operation, it could be could its operation could start on 1st April. In other words, to apply retrospective. That's the same with Malta. We're still struggling with making arrangements for the signing because of the technicalities. Thank you.
Does that cover your question, or you wanted to follow up another hearing?
Yeah, just a question of clarity, responding to the answer to Honourable Swart's question. The implication of this protocol with Oman is that if you, correct me if I'm wrong, but if a South African company pays out a dividend to a company or a shareholder in Oman, and they own more than, say, 10% of the company, they pay a third of the dividend tax that we do in South Africa. Is that equivalent? I'm not sure if you have the figures at hand, but are we talking about equivalent rates for those other 10 countries? In other words, are these countries all receiving some form of discount relative to our domestic dividend tax rate?
Chair, yes, that preferential rate is something which virtually all countries use in their bilateral tax treaties, 5%. What would differ is the shareholding. Traditionally in South Africa we've tried to push it as low as 10%, because if you're buying 10% of a major company, that's a lot of money. Other countries would insist on going as high as perhaps a 25% shareholding. So the percentage in relation to the shareholding can change from treaty to treaty. But normally, in all of our treaties, the lower rate would be 5% in it, and that's in virtually all 70 of them. There might be one or two exceptions, but not lower, perhaps higher.
All right. Are we covered?
Sorry.
Or do you want to make a follow-up?
One very quick follow-up. I'm just interested in the logic behind, I mean, this effectively incentivizes foreign shareholding in terms of you're paying less tax on your dividends if you're a foreign shareholder than if you're local. What's the economic logic behind that, building that incentive into the system?
Thank you, Chair. Well, it goes back to the basic rationale for a double taxation agreement, which is to encourage investment across borders. Now, if you look at the situation in South Africa up to now, dividends have been neutral in relation to taxation. But I don't want to make the comparison between domestic and foreign. It's first and foremost an instrument to encourage foreign direct investment. And if you're looking at significant shareholdings of companies, I think we can agree that that's significant direct investment, and most countries are very keen to incentivize that one way or another.
So broadly, what you are saying is that we do whatever in pursuance of ensuring that we've got a very competitive tax rate in this agreement.
I understand the difficulties to compare domestic and foreign jurisdictions, but it does, because many people were expecting the dividend withholding rate to come in at 10%, whereas domestically it came in at 15%. So it's just a comment from our side. We did express views on that whole issue in our report. But it is interesting that it comes in at 5% and then at 10% in all other cases, purely a comment from our side that it does seem that your domestic investors then are prejudiced to a certain degree because of the increase as a that's three times in the one situation and 10% versus 15%, where you also want domestic investment. But it's not your terrain to comment on policy. I appreciate that, and it's against the background of multilateral negotiations. But it's just something we need to bear in mind as a committee. Thank you, Chair.
Quite correct. Yeah, this is our work going forward in terms of also at some stage talking about the impact of this withholding tax of capital gains tax and the dividend tax. So basically, because I know there was an argument in our debate about dividend tax, inhibiting, investment, you know. So going forward as a committee, I think we will be seizing this responsibility. And thank you very much for your responses.
I apologize, I'm being very slow. I just have one more quick follow-up.
All right, thank you.
I'm sorry I'm catching up slowly, but I need to find out, did we have, before dividend tax we had STC, did we have tax agreements with regards to STC? I'm trying to think through the logic. I would imagine we didn't, because it didn't matter where the dividends went to. The tax was paid on the company side. If I'm correct in that, then by imposing dividends tax, and especially by imposing it, as Honourable Swart said, at a relatively higher level than the tax protocols we've signed, we do actually have a situation now, a new situation, where we are effectively penalising domestic investors, and it's something which has only arisen since we switched from STC to dividend tax. I know the Honourable Swart made a statement, but perhaps I would like to turn it into a question. Is it foreseen that this is going to have any potentially negative effects, and how would we mitigate against that if that was the case? If we do have a kind of unintended consequence in terms of shifting the cost of domestic versus foreign investments in South African companies.
I'm not sure if will we be able to get a succinct response from the presenters, because I think their mandate, of course, is more on the foreign side, and having to give an opinion around the impact of this difference. I'm not sure if we will be doing justice to that matter. And now. But if you have a response, you can give a response to the matter.
Just from a SARS point of view, my colleague might want to say something further if on the policy question. But the start of the question dealt with, so what happened with STC under a treaty? As the committee is aware, STC was imposed on the company, whereas the dividend tax is being imposed on the shareholder, which of course results in a major difference in treatment under the agreements. STC being imposed on the company paying it was considered to be a tax on business profits, and there was no limitation. Although it was a covered tax, there was no limitation. Now, by imposing the tax directly on the shareholder, then Article 10 dealing with dividends will apply, and therefore those limitations which we've now negotiated will become applicable in respect of those dividend flows. Chair, yes, for the rest, I would prefer not to comment on the policies.
I've not much to say, except to say that when these protocols were renegotiated, they were negotiated when we had an understanding that new dividends tax rate would be 10%. And it was upon that basis that we renegotiated that. The decision to increase the rate of dividends tax domestically was taken this year, as you are aware. And therefore, I wouldn't want to comment further on that issue.
Thank you very much. I simply say we are noting this discrepancy, and obviously going forward, we'll have to, when we do our work, as to how these new taxation provisions affect our constituents, we'll have to zoom into this difference, but also affect, the investment in as far as growing our economy is concerned, you know. So we'll have to look into that going forward. But the discrepancy is clearly noted. So we now move to, we're done with the presentation, by the way. Now we can move to the point where we must read the report to the committee for us to rectify. Mano, on this paper, please. So it's just unfortunate you arrive late. The next thing you want to hold a meeting at once. So that's why I'm not sure that. Now we are at a stage where we deal with reading the report to the committee on the Oman rectification. But I must indicate Oman and the Multinational Convention has not been referred by the National Assembly table. But that's an administrative process. I mean, we have dealt with the ratification. So that, I mean, obviously, as it is referred, at whatever time it will be referred to us, then it can be signed off by the chairperson. So it's just an administrative process. So what we are requesting is the Standing Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by the Parliament of the Supplementary Protocol amending the Double Taxation Agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Sultanate of Oman for the avoidance of double taxation and the prevention of fiscal evasion with respect to taxes on income, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, approve the third supplementary protocol. A report to be considered. So can we get someone opposing?
I move to him. Thank you.
Any seconder?
Second the move.
The Standing Committee on the Finance, having considered the request for approval,
so before we move with other reports, we then have to go through the Liberia formal rectification process.
Thank you, Chair.
Let's ask for the present an opportunity to take us through.
There are, in fact, four agreements which we're putting in front of your committee today. Three of them, Dominica, Gibraltar, and Liberia, are what we call TIAs, which is Tax Information Exchange Agreements, whereas the Multilateral Convention is a convention signed at this stage by 34 countries, but which also has as its basis exchange of information and general collaboration or cooperation, perhaps a better word, between tax authorities. chairs, as you pointed out, all four of these were in fact presented to the committee in October prior to their signature. The whole rationale behind these tax information exchange agreements and the signing of the multilateral agreement is part of a drive to create a network of treaties which will enable us to ensure transparency, effective exchange of information, and in the case of the multilateral chair, assistance in collection. This has all resulted from the G20 campaign which began as far back as 2008, but which for the first time gave countries like South Africa the opportunity to enter into agreements with certain jurisdictions in the world where previously there was absolute secrecy and there was no ways we could find out what our residents were doing in those jurisdictions. I refer particularly to bank secrecy, etc. So this has been an enormous opportunity for countries around the world to enter into agreements with these jurisdictions in order to be able to obtain an effective exchange of information. It's also very important to realize that one of the ways of tax evasion or avoidance, whatever you want to call it, has been through transfer pricing. And if you don't have proper exchange of information legal basis with another country, it's virtually impossible to come to a right answer in relation to a transfer pricing investigation. So these agreements are also very important for issues of transfer pricing. The difference between the two, Chair, is that a tax information exchange agreement will allow only for exchange of information on request. The multilateral, which I will move to after these three, has full exchange of information on request, automatic, spontaneous. So that's the difference between the two. If I could then start with Dominica, Chair, which is the first one, and that's a TIA, Tax Information Exchange Agreement. It follows the international model on exchange of information. Carry on. Article 1 of the agreement gives you the scope and says that you can exchange information that's foreseeably relevant to the enforcement of the domestic laws of the party concerning taxes. It includes information that's foreseeably relevant to the determination, assessment or enforcement or collection of tax with respect to persons subject to such tax, and it requires that the requested party shall ensure that effective exchange of information is not unduly prevented or delayed. Chair, the rationale is simply this, that if you delay information, it has the same effect as not exchanging information. So you should not ever delay in replying to a request for information. The taxes covered in this agreement shall apply to any identical taxes imposed after the date of signature of the agreement in addition to or in place of the existing taxes. Article 5 gets to the nitty-gritty and says exchange of information shall be exchanged without regard to whether the requested party needs such information for its own tax purposes, excuse me, a domestic tax interest, and also whether the conduct being investigated would constitute a crime under the laws of the requested party, dual criminality. And what I mean by that, Chair, is simply that if I ask for information from one of these jurisdictions, it's quite likely that in view of the absence of effective taxing systems in that country, they might not have a tax interest in the transaction or the investment that I want information of. that cannot be used to deny the request. Also, if I'm investigating something which is a crime in my country, it doesn't matter if it's not a crime in the other country. They have to give us the information which relates to that request. So domestic law should allow for the exchange of information also, which is held by banks, ownership information, other financial institutions, and any person, including nominees and trustees acting in an agency or fiduciary capacity, the legal and beneficial ownership of companies, partnerships, foundations, and other persons. Also, in the case of trust, information on settlers, trustees, protectors, and beneficiaries. Some of those terms, Chair, are not relevant to South Africa. For argument's sake, foundations and protectors is not something that we have. But those are issues in the other country. It does not create an obligation for a party to obtain and provide ownership information with respect to publicly traded companies or public collective investment schemes unless such information can be obtained without giving rise to disproportionate difficulties. It also allows for tax examinations abroad, and it allows for representatives of the competent authority of the requesting party to enter the territory of the requested party, but to the extent permitted under its domestic laws. So, presence at interviews, those interviews will be conducted by the requested party. If you're the requesting party, you're virtually there, could I say, as a guest chair. Everything that's done is subject to approval of the requested party. Possibility of declining a request. In Article 7, the competent authority may decline to assist where the disclosure of the information requested is contrary to public policy. It does not impose any obligation to provide items subject to legal privilege or any trade, business, industrial, commercial, professional, secret or trade process. But a request for information shall not be refused on the grounds that the tax claim giving rise to the request is disputed by the taxpayer under examination or investigation. Then we turn to confidentiality. All information provided and received by the competent authorities of the parties shall be kept confidential. It's subject to the same rules of confidentiality which apply across the board in countries in relation to information on their taxpayers. Article 9, dealing with costs. Indirect costs shall be borne by the requested party. Direct costs shall be borne by the requesting party. And in cases like that, we say that if those costs are expected to be significant, the requested party should then immediately notify the requesting party and say, look, this is going to cost something. We're looking at significant amounts. It's then up to the requesting party to decide whether to proceed with that request. There's a mutual agreement procedure under Article 10, which says where difficulties or doubts arise between the parties regarding the implementation or interpretation of this agreement, the respective competent authorities shall use their best efforts to resolve the matter by mutual agreement. Those, Chair, are the slides on Dominica. I have to say, Chair, that in relation to Gibraltar and Liberia, it's fairly similar. I can go through the same process, no problem, but it's virtually the same thing again and again. But Chair, it's up to you. I can do that. It's not a problem.
All right. Well, members, if you are having issues on Liberia and Gibraltar, feel free to raise those issues. Because I went through the presentation, I realized that there are similarities. So could you please send of course, members an opportunity to pose questions if there are any specific questions. Honorable Chabalala.
Thank you, Mr. This might sound more general question,
But I just want to find out around the parties involved, because you mentioned specifically on this one that there were 34 countries. So I would want to find out what is the fundamental issue. Do you have an issue around the number of countries to get probably the credibility of the agreement itself for it to proceed or rather take precedence, or it will depend from a country to country, as far as I would want to find out the tax laws are concerned and how do we do the agreement. Thanks.
Honourable, sir.
Chair, this is just a general question. In terms of Section 4 of our Income Tax Act, it ensures confidentiality of tax information. Is that reciprocated by countries that we have the agreement with? Do they have a similar clauses in there or in their tax legislation to protect? I'm not talking, I understand obviously where criminality is concerned, but in terms of Section 4, as you are aware, there is that confidentiality of all tax matters. Could you just enlighten us as to what is the practice in other countries?
Any other
question? Just a comment on the domestic law should allow for exchange of. Just on the should, what is the current status regarding the importance of transparent information in terms of our domestic law? We are looking at the future here. Should allow for exchange of. I'd just like to know what the current status is of our domestic law.
Honourable Chair,
thank
Maris, I hope you have made your mind on this one. Alright, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, yes, I think I was misleading a little bit, because the 34 signatories are actually the multilateral which I have yet to deal with. May I answer, or hopefully answer, when I get to that one. Sorry, I should have been more clear on that. The others are bilateral, of course. The second question was the confidentiality provisions of Section 4, and I think the thrust of the question was in regard to reciprocity in the other state. Firstly, Section 108 of the Income Tax Act allows us to enter into agreements with other countries in respect of exchange of information. However, we always make it subject to reciprocal confidentiality. So for argument's sake, if I'm providing information on request to your country, I would provide it subject to the provisions of the article in the treaty. And the article in the treaty says it shall be kept confidential, and the same standards that I have will be applied in your country. So on that basis, we ensure that the minimum standard is the standard of the country which is supplying the information. And I think that addresses the whole question of reciprocity. Clearly, you're going to get situations where eventually perhaps a tax issue ends up in public court. I think we've seen that in South Africa, in which case it's then in the public domain anyway. But until then, it's subject to those strict laws of confidentiality on a reciprocal basis. I'm not sure I was getting the third question so much. At this stage, in all of our agreements, the question is not about should exchange information, it says we shall. And there's an obligation. And for as long as we've had tax treaties, there has been an exchange of information with our treaty partners. The question has always been to what extent we could. And perhaps in prior years, it was more difficult to do certain things because of the lack of technology which we have today. So for argument's sake, we're only now starting to explore properly automatic exchange of information because now we have the technology, which was more difficult in the past. But do we? Yes, we do. And that's the current state.
Any follow-up?
Just a
recommend, just in terms of combating international tax avoidance, so we are, you know, we are in force doing that. It is the current status.
Yes.
Chair, I might mention that probably one of the biggest tax cases we've had in the last, I don't know how many years, had as one of the foundation stones of its success, the fact that we were able to exchange information. And, I mean, the tax bill there is plus a billion. So, yes, it's worth it and it's being done.
We're just about to wrap up, Okay, you can come in. Oh, Honorable, you can come in. You are not the Honorable Lady.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just looking at the letter from the Department of Justice, which is amended to the back of the, appended to the back of the agreement. They recommend that it would be in the interest of both parties to insert provision in the agreement dealing with the amendment thereof. I just scanned the agreement. I'm wondering, did SARS take on board their recommendation? And if not, why not?
And I will read
it. No, Chair, it's just a clarity-seeking question around this Article 10, where the mutual agreement is actually encouraged when there are doubts in the implementation. Does that mutual agreement regard that does it get the full status of an agreement if it is just a mutual one? So I want to get clarity on this one, because maybe countries would want to use these mutual understanding and agreements in terms of saying no, there is nothing binding in a mutual agreement. You can actually say, no, this time around I'm no longer using that mutual one. Let's start afresh and then renegotiate. Thanks.
Any
further
question? I can see. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. If I could just deal with the first one. While I remember, when you get older, it's more difficult. That mutual agreement article in the Tax Information Exchange Agreement merely relates to any interpretations or difficulties arising from the treaty as such. It does not take away the binding effect of the fact that there is an obligation to exchange information on request. There might be a dispute as to who has authority to arrange the visit to the other country, etc. That kind of could I say minor issue, but in relation to the meat of the agreement, I don't think there's anything that would take away the binding power of that agreement under international law. So that's merely an article which is put there, which enables the two authorities to perhaps discuss issues between themselves, as opposed to dealing with really major issues. Chair, the other question. When justice look at these treaties, as they've told us time and again, they make suggestions. They're not saying we have to do it, because the one thing they do recognize is that it's an agreement between two countries, and you can't just be unilateral in your approach. Double taxation agreements as such, and tax information exchange agreements as such, the international models have no article which deals with amendment. So we have always tried to be to follow the path of consensus in reaching these international agreements, because it makes it much easier for interpretation across borders when you at least have the outline or the basis which is followed by all the other countries in the world. Having said that, the question would be, so what happens if you do want to amend? It's a case of simply approaching the other country and saying, we have an issue, we need to talk about this and this and that. As for argument's sake, Chair, we did with the protocols relating to dividend taxation. And not one of those countries turned around to us and said, sorry, we're not going to negotiate. The upshot of that would be, if they refuse to negotiate, the next step in the case would be, well, sorry, we see now a reason to terminate the treaty. So it's just an article we have in none of our treaties, and justice make the suggestion and they make it. It's something that we prefer not to follow for those reasons, sir.
All right, thank you very much. That will take us then to reading the report to the committee now, because I think all the issues have been clear. The report of the Standing Committee on Finance on the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Republic of Liberia for the exchange of information relating to tax matters, dated 13 March 2012. The Standing Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Republic of Liberia for the exchange of information relating to tax matters, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Can we move for the adoption of the report?
I'm not sure that we adopt.
Seconded.
Move that we second, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Harris.
The report of the Standing Committee.
A report of the Standing Committee on Finance on the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of Gibraltar for the exchange of information relating to tax matters, dated 13 March 2012. The Standing Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of Gibraltar for the exchange of information related to tax matters, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Can we get the mover for approval? Honorable Swart.
I propose.
Thank you very much. Second.
I second the motion. Yes.
Thank you very much. We move to the next report. A report of the Standing Committee on Finance on the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Commonwealth of Dominica for the exchange of information with respect to taxes and tax matters, dated 13 March 2012. The Standing Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by the Parliament of the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Commonwealth of Dominica for the exchange of information with respect to taxes and tax matters, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, approve the first agreement. Any mover for approval?
Chair, I move for the approval.
Seconder? Honorable Chawalala?
I second, sir.
Thank you very much. The three reports have been duly approved by the committee. Now we can move to the next item.
Thank you very much, Chair. Now I would like to turn to the Mutual Administrative Assistance, the Multilateral Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters, which we brought to the committee in October. And I'm pleased to say that since that date, Chair, the number of signatories have doubled. There are now 34 countries which have signed this, and I would like, if you permit, just to read the list. It's Argentina, it's Australia, Azerbaijan, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Costa Rica, Denmark, Finland, France, Georgia, Germany, Iceland, India, Indonesia, Ireland, Italy. Sorry, the first one was Iceland. Did I say Iceland? Dyslexic. Italy, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Moldova, Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Russia, Slovenia, South Africa, Spain, Sweden, Turkey, Ukraine, United Kingdom and United States. As I mentioned in the introduction to these, Chair, this agreement goes beyond the Tax Information Exchange Agreement in that it provides a full basis for exchange of information between the parties to this agreement. And it follows the same principle that we have in our more modern double taxation agreements, in that it specifically outlaws issues such as bank secrecy, domestic tax interest, etc. So the big plus point for us is that there are a number of signatories already to this multilateral with whom we do not have a tax information exchange agreement, with whom we do not have a double taxation agreement. So via this agreement, we have better coverage in relation to exchange of information and obtaining transparency. In relation to some of the countries mentioned here to with whom we already have double taxation agreements, such as Canada, the United States, France, which are older double taxation agreements, Chair, they still had the old exchange of information article. And those agreements did not have articles allowing assistance in collection of taxes. We achieved that by becoming a signatory to this multilateral. So there's a number of benefits to be had in relation to this for South Africa. If I now turn to the slides on this multilateral, Chair, with your permission, I'll just go through them. The purpose of the convention is, of course, to allow for effective exchange of information and administrative assistance between the tax authorities of the states which are party to the convention. It closely follows the articles on exchange of information and assistance in collection, those particular provisions which are currently present in the OECD Model Tax Convention. And, Chair, I can say that from tomorrow, exactly also in line with the United Nations Model Double Taxation Agreement, which is to be released tomorrow in New York. In relation to Chapter 1, Article 1 deals with object of the convention and persons covered, and it allows for administrative assistance which comprises exchange of information, including simultaneous tax examinations and participations in tax examinations abroad, assistance in the recovery of taxes, which is important as well, and then of lesser importance, service of documents. And the assistance is to be provided whether the person affected is a resident or national of a party or of any other state. Taxes covered. The convention applies to the widest possible range of taxes imposed by the parties, which is in line, Chair, with what we do under our double taxation agreements. We extend that to taxes of every kind and description. Forms of assistance, Section 1, Article 4. is a general provision which allows for the exchange of information that is foreseeably relevant to the enforcement of the domestic laws of the party concerning taxes covered by the convention. It then becomes more specific in that it starts dealing with how will this be done. So Article 5 says the first method is on request. Article 6, the next one, goes to the automatic exchange. And this is something that all of us countries are striving to meet. And then in Article 7, it talks about the spontaneous exchange of information. Now, I think the first two, on request and automatic, are pretty apparent. Spontaneous looks at a situation where I might be doing an investigation in my country, Chair, and I see something and I say to myself, wow, that would be really appropriate for your country. You would be interested in knowing that. Spontaneously, therefore, I should make that exchange, although it might not be part of an automatic system or on request. So, Article 8 deals with simultaneous tax examinations at the request of one of them, two or more parties, shall consult together for the purposes of determining cases and procedures for simultaneous tax examinations. Article 9 deals with tax examinations abroad, and once again, the onus is on the requested party to say what rules, what protocols will be applied in respect of that examination in the other state. Article 11 then turns to the recovery of tax claims. It's in line, Chair, with the article we have in our normal double taxation agreements in relation to assistance in recovery. What I want to stress is it does not allow for recovery where it's not a final claim. So while there's still a possibility of it being challenged in the courts of the country where that claim has arisen, there will be no assistance until it's final. So in other words, there's no question of the merits of the case as such being looked at afresh in the courts of another country. Article 12 deals with conservancy, and that's where there's a risk that the taxpayer might get rid of his assets in that other country. We can ask that those assets be conserved in that other country until time that the claim has become final and payable. Article 17 deals with the service of documents. South Africa has reserved on this particular one. We don't mind doing it via post, but we regard that there's already the mutual legal assistance treaty with most of these countries, which allows for service of documents. Article 21, Chair, provisions relates to the protection of persons and limits to the obligation to provide assistance. It goes through 8 issues where assistance, you're not obliged to give that assistance. Firstly, it does not oblige you to carry out measures at variance with its own laws or administrative practices, or to carry out measures which would be contrary to public policy. To supply information which is not obtainable under your own law or administrative practice, or under the laws of the applicant state or its administrative practice. And that looks at the principle of reciprocity. I shouldn't be asking you to get information that if you asked me, I couldn't give you. And I think that's only fair. To supply information which would disclose any trade, business, industrial, commercial, professional secrets or trade process, or information which is contrary to public policy. E, to provide administrative assistance if and insofar as it considers the taxation in the applicant state to be contrary to generally accepted taxation principles. F, to provide administrative assistance in the case of tax law which discriminates against the national of the requested state. G, to provide administrative assistance if the applicant state has not pursued all reasonable measures itself to get that information and to provide assistance in recovery, that's assistance in collection, where the administrative burden for that state is clearly disproportionate to the benefit to be derived by the applicant state. I think that makes a bit of economic sense. I'm not going to ask you to spend $1 million to collect $100,000. That's a little bit bad. Bank secrecy or the absence of a domestic tax interest cannot be used under any of those issues to deny a request for exchange of information. Secrecy, we have the same kind of protection here, and this goes back to an earlier question, in relation to the confidentiality we impose under our law, the confidentiality we impose under our treaties. In fact, when you request to become a signatory to this multilateral chair, the first thing they ask you to do is to give you a full rundown of the confidentiality laws, etc., in your country, so that they can be sure that information given to you will be treated with that same degree of respect for that issue. Article 26 costs, it's the normal. Ordinary costs will be borne by the requested state. Extraordinary costs shall be borne by the applicant state. And once again, if there's any question of there being extraordinary costs, you would go back to the requesting state and inform them of such. Article 27 deals with other international agreements or arrangements. It says clearly that the assistance provided by this convention does not limit it, nor is it limited by assistance contained in existing or future international agreements or other arrangements between the parties or other instruments which relate to cooperation in tax matters. Finally, Article 30 allows you to make reservations relating to the taxes covered, tax claims, service of documents, and the entry into force date. You then also have to make declarations in relation to the taxes covered, the competent authority in your country, and the meaning of the term national. So South Africa's formal ratification notice, the instrument which will be sent to the depository, advises that once we've approved the ratification of the convention, it's subject to the following notifications, declarations, and reservations. Firstly, taxes to which the convention would apply are the income tax, withholding tax on royalties, tax on foreign entertainers and sports persons, turnover tax on micro businesses, the secondary tax on companies, although it will be terminated as from 31 March, the dividend tax with an effective date 1 April 2012, withholding tax on interest, effective date 1 January 2013. We also cover taxes on capital gains, estate duty, donations tax, transfer duty, value-added tax, excise tax, and securities transfer tax. As in all of our treaties, Chair, the competent authority is defined as being the Commissioner for the South African Revenue Service or an authorized representative of the Commissioner. With regard to the definition of the term national, we use the same same definition of national as we have in our double taxation agreements. Broadly, any individual possessing the nationality or citizenship of South Africa and any legal person, partnership, association, or other entity deriving its status as such from the laws in force in South Africa. The reservation we have is relation to taxes on income, profits, capital gains, net wealth, which are imposed on behalf of a political subdivision or local authority, which we do not impose at the moment. Social security contributions, ownership of motor vehicles, use or ownership of movable property other than motor vehicles, and finally, taxes in categories referred to in subparagraph 3 above, which are imposed on behalf of political subdivisions or local authorities of a party. And then, as I said earlier, in relation to the service of documents, we reserve our position on that because we regard the service of documents legally to be covered by the mutual legal assistance treaties which we have with other countries, except in relation to postal delivery of documents on behalf of a treaty partner. And Chair, that's the multilateral. As I said earlier, it certainly has the potential to be of great benefit to South Africa in that firstly we now have access to more countries in relation to exchange of information, and we also have modernized exchange of information articles and included assistance in collection provisions in relation to some of our older treaty partners where the current double taxation agreement did not allow for that. So we're very happy with it, to put it mildly. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you very much. I'll allow members to pose questions.
Chair, I understand there was a bit of concern about the information held by banks and financial institutions, and that gave rise to a legal opinion that was requested from the state law advisors as to the impact of this treaty and regard when one has regard to our Promotion of Access to Information Act, and there seemed to be a bit of a concern in that regard. The state law advisors then, in their opinion, relied on your view as SARS that the confidentiality safeguards under the treaties and our Income Tax Act meet the required standards in this regard, and that South Africa is on record as supporting exchanges of information without regard to bank secrecy, a practice in line with the rest of the world. They had a concern, and it seemed that their concern was met by what you told them. But I would raise the same concern and just alert you again to the Promotion of Access to Information Act and how that fits into this. Clearly, the provisions of the protocol are subject to applicable domestic legislation. But is it still a concern? That's the question. Thank you.
Any further questions? My question is about the relationship that is prevailing.
That is prevailing among, or maybe the relationship between these treaties and other provision of law, I mean the law enforcement provision international, you know. How is this taken consideration for an example in the Interpol operations? And there are many, of course, I know, arrangements that are being made internationally around issues of crimes committed, money laundering and all those things, you know. But also, how is this accommodating some of the initiatives that are championed by the Financial Services Intelligence Agency? How is this related to some of these provisions? Honorable Harris.
Thanks, Chair. I wasn't following closely enough when the list of countries concerned was read, but does it include any country where bank secrecy is prevalent, like Switzerland or Singapore or Luxembourg? Because that really raises or underlines the relevance of the question that the Honourable Swart asked.
All right, thank you.
Yes, Chair. Yeah, I think the
unaware. Do you have this opinion, or would you like to look at?
Thank you, Chair. I'll talk from memory, such as it is. When the Justice Law Advisors raised this issue with us, the last thing we needed was for South Africa to be labelled a jurisdiction with bank secrecy. And that was not the intention of, I think, Parliament or the people writing the law at that stage. I don't know if I'm being presumptuous in saying that, but I think that's a fair assumption. So we went to see the South African Law Reform Committee, who were busy at that stage with finalising, in their view at least, that particular law, the promotion of access. I can't remember the full name of the law, sorry, Chair. I think the Honourable Member knows which one I'm referring to. Sorry. And we said to them, does this give us a problem? And they said no. In fact, there are exemptions which are allowed in relation to exchange of information, which you would be obliged to give under international treaties, provided that they are subject to sufficient standards of confidentiality. What standards do you apply? And our reply was, we use the standards of confidentiality set out in our domestic law and in the OECD convention, model convention on taxation of income and capital. And they said, well, that's more than enough. That would meet quite clearly with the exceptions which are provided for under that law. And on that basis, we went back to Justice. We had a further discussion with Justice in that they said to us, but Article 4 of your domestic law wouldn't allow you to exchange information across borders. And we had to point out to them that in terms of Section 108, we were specifically authorised to enter into agreements, be they bilateral or multilateral, which enabled us to exchange information, and then they were happy. And since then, we've had no issues with the Department of Justice on that. But yes, this was one of the preliminary areas that we did address. And I think from our side, we're confident. And the South African Law Reform Committee or Commission even agreed to tweak the words in such a way as to make it absolutely clear that exchange of information under these agreements would have no issues for us. Subsequent to that, we've been subjected to our peer review, Chair, by the Global Forum on Transparency and Exchange of Information, and I think, turning to my colleague, they had no issues with in relation to the relationship between that law and the exchange of information. The second question was, I think, in relation to, was your question, Chair, and that was in relation to Interpol and other agencies. The exchange of information under these treaties can only be done between competent authorities. So in other words, in South Africa, that would be the commissioner for SARS. It can then only be used for the purposes which are clearly spelt out in the agreement, which would relate to tax processes. So that if you wanted to charge someone criminally under the tax code, there would be no problem with that. And then that information is going to spread. But your basic channel of exchange of information is from competent authority to competent authority. Its use then is governed by the confidentiality provisions in the treaty itself. Now I've forgotten the other one, jurisdiction. Oh, yes, other jurisdictions. Chair, when I remember the first day I came to the committee about these tax information exchange agreements, and the question then in my mind was, does this go far enough as a tax person? And I've always thought, no, it doesn't, because this should only be the first step in an international process. Because under tax information exchange agreements, the exchange is only on request. And that's a little bit limiting. What you really need, the big one, is automatic and spontaneous. That's the one which is the first prize, if I could call it that, Chair. And in fact, in Cape Town last week, we had a meeting of the African Tax Administrators Forum Council, which I happened to be at as an observer. And the head of the OECD, the new head of the OECD Center for Tax Policy Administration, was there. And I asked him the question, where does the OECD see this exchange of information, this drive for transparency going? And his reply to me was much what I wanted to hear, that those jurisdictions which you've referred to and which I'm not going to repeat, but other jurisdictions such as the Channel Islands, etc., etc., the traditional old areas where there was so much bank secrecy, are starting to apply to sign this treaty. They're already looking to move beyond exchange of information on request. And we've had a lot of cooperation from a number of those jurisdictions. It might be more difficult in relation to one or two of the ones the Honourable Member mentioned. But, sir, I regard this to be the first step in a process of achieving complete transparency, and I think that the international bodies are also looking to get to that position in due course. Might not be this year, it might not be next year, but hey, that's where we need to be. So I think that's all I'd like to say in relation to that.
All is work in progress. There are follow-up questions, Honourable Harris.
Unfortunately, we just don't have a list of the signatories. So my question was whether Switzerland, Singapore, or Luxembourg were signatories.
Sorry, the answer is
none of them.
Not yet.
Okay. But Chair, sorry. I mean, hypothetically, if one of those countries where bank secrecy was codified in their law was to sign up to this treaty, and we were to request information that was secret on their side, I think what the state law advisor is saying is that the PIA Act would require us to reveal that information. So, as a South African government, if we had received information through a treaty like this, which was subject to secrecy in another jurisdiction, I gather that was their concern, whether the treaty is compatible with the Protection of Access to Information Act. And I think this has turned into more of a comment than a question, but I think you've probably satisfied me, provided those countries aren't signatories. I mean, as soon as somebody like Switzerland signs, it does raise questions for me, certainly.
I am satisfied with the explanation. I think it is useful that the last comment on that paragraph, it is to be noted that the provisions in the protocol are made subject to the applicable provisions of the domestic law of the Republic, and that is the PIA legislation. But maybe just it might be useful for future where you have a request for a response. This paragraph, it's just a side comment, but it says this was in a recent double taxation. We alerted you. That's recent. And we note that Act was passed in 2000. So that was 12 years ago. I'm not quite sure how the South African Law Commission could have assisted you, but it's just by the way, because they have they do incredibly good work. They did a process. They then brought it to Parliament in 98-99. I was part of the process. We then passed the legislation. There's no way that the Law Reform Commission could tweak the legislation subsequent. So I think, just to assist you in future, leave it at that. You don't have to comment. Okay, thank you.
Okay, anything from your side? National Fajarian. Is that a sound advice? All right, thank you very much. Members, indeed, tax laws are as good as administrative provisions. I mean, without an appropriate administration, obviously, those tax laws will just be tax laws, I mean, in book, but without any effective implementation. So I think this particular approach is a step in the right direction. Obviously, acknowledging, I mean, the variance that is there among the various tax provisions in different countries, I think is a step in the right direction. And I'm then tempted to present a report to yourself as a report of the Standing Committee on Finance on the protocol to the Convention of Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters, dated 13 March 2012. The Standing Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the protocol to the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, subsection 2 of the Constitution, approve this said protocol. Can I get a mover for approval? A mover for approval?
Chair, I move for the approval of the report.
Any seconder? Honorable Harris?
Seconded, Chair.
Thank you very much. That brings us now to the next item. I don't know if members would like us to take a preliminary brief before we break for tea, or we break for tea. I was of the opinion that let's just proceed first, we conclude our business. And then tea is here, those who want to have tea, they can have tea while we proceed. All right, thank you very much. Let's move to the next presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I'll promise to be brief. It's the preliminary hearing for our tax information exchange agreement with Samoa. And Chair, it's very much similar to the tiers that we've in fact had ratified, put forward to you for ratification today. So if I could just briefly go through the provisions, and I'll say again, this is preliminary. Scope of the agreement in Article 1 says that you will exchange information that's foreseeably relevant to the enforcement of your domestic laws, information that is foreseeably relevant to the determination, assessment, enforcement, or collection of tax, or the investigation or prosecution of criminal tax matters. Taxes covered every kind and description which are imposed by the parties at the date of signature. Excuse me. Exchange of information shall be exchanged without regard to whether there's a domestic tax interest, as to whether the conduct being investigated would constitute a crime, dual criminality. Domestic law should allow for exchange of information held by banks, other financial institutions, and any person, including nominees, trustees, acting in an agency or fiduciary capacity. Information regarding the legal and beneficial ownership of companies, partnerships, etc., including in the case of collective investment schemes, information on shares, units, and other interests, and in the case of trusts, information on settlors, trustees, and beneficiaries. It does not create an obligation for a party to obtain or provide ownership information with respect to publicly traded companies, which is not a problem. You can normally find that on the website anyway. It allows for tax examinations abroad, allows for representatives of the competent authority to enter the territory of the requested party, to the extent permitted under its domestic laws, all subject to approval of the requested party. Competent authority may decline to assist where the disclosure of the information is contrary to public policy. The agreement does not impose any obligation to provide items subject to legal privilege or any trade, business, industrial, commercial or professional secret or trade process. A request for information shall not be refused on the ground that the tax claim giving rise to the request is disputed. Article 7 deals with confidentiality. Once again, information received shall be disclosed only to persons or authorities, including courts and administrative bodies concerned with the purposes specified in Article 1, shall may not be used for any purpose other than for the purposes stated in Article 1 without the express written consent of the competent authority of the requested party. Article 8 deals with costs, the direct and indirect again, and once again, requesting parties should be notified if the costs are expected to be significant. There's a mutual agreement procedure article, as there was in the other tiers, and that, Chair, is the entire context of this particular tier. Just in time.
Yeah, I look at the workload
there, so that I can quickly recap. Thank you very much for the presentation. Members, there any specific impression? Same. Okay.
The same
balance. Yeah. Oh, there is a consensus. Okay. So this is just a preliminary briefing. At some stage it will be referred back and you will have to rectify. So thank you very much for the presentation. And fortunately, that was the last item. Members, there are copies of a provisional report, program for the second term. So I'll appreciate that if you grab a copy before you go for recess, because we are just waiting for the power that be to approve. So I think they will then give an indication to all of us of what to expect for the next term. It's not final, but I think it's giving guidance on what to expect for our next term. On behalf of the chairperson and the committee, let me take this opportunity to thank you very much, the collective team of National Treasury and SARS, on your elaborate presentation, and wishing you all the luck that you need, because I understand this is not a smooth sail. You are really carrying our interest, and it's not an easy task. Negotiating with some of these countries in this world of dog eat dog, it's very key that you must be blessed wherever you go. And on behalf of the committee, I think it will be appropriate on my side to really commend you for the good work that you are doing for our country, and wishing you all of the best in this struggle. To me, the struggle that is continuing. Thank you very much. Oh, you wanted to say something, madam?
Chair, I can only say I thank you very much for those kind words, and I would particularly like to thank the committee for their time and consideration of these agreements this morning. It's appreciated, and what you've said is absolutely right, and thank you so much.
I hope you are speaking on behalf of the collective. The tandem has not come either. All right, thank you very much, members, for your valuable contribution, and this meeting is officially adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.